Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer Corinne Demas. Demas is author of a memoir called 11 Stories High, growing up in Stuyvesant Town, 1948 to 1968. She has also written two collections of short stories, a collection of poems, and numerous books for children. Her most recent work is the well-received novel The Writing Circle. It was published just a few weeks ago by Voice Hyperion Books. Demas is also professor of English at Mount Holyoke College and a fiction editor for the national literary journal The Massachusetts Review. I'm speaking to Corinne Demas by phone from her home in Cape Cod. Corinne Demas, thank you so much for joining us. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit. In 2000, you published a memoir called 11 Stories High, Growing Up in Stuyvesant Town, 1948 to 1968. Well, what prompted you to write about your early years at that point in time?
I started thinking about my childhood when my son was a little boy and was remarking on how amazing it was that I used an elevator to get to work in my office building at Mount Holyoke College. And I discovered that although an elevator was something I'd always grown up with and had been a major part of my life, for my son, who grew up in the small town of South Hadley, it was really exotic. And it started to make me think about my own childhood and to think about aspects of it that I'd always taken for granted that were, in fact, rather unusual for other people. And that's what got the memoir going.
Can you tell us how your childhood has informed you as a writer?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think when you grow up in a city and then spend the next part of your life in the country, you're always thinking about that contrast. And I think that I notice things in my environment now that are special to me because they're so different from the things that were part of the of my everyday world when I was growing up. So I think that it's not just where I live, but the fact that I live in a place that has a very different texture from the place where I grew up, that has is constantly informing my writing.
You said in that memoir that Stuyvesant Town wasn't just a place where I happened to grow up, but a way of life. Can you tell us a little bit about the flavor of that?
Well, Stuyvesant Town was a middle-class community, what they called them a utopian community, and it was very much, it functioned like a small town, but there it was right in the middle of Manhattan. And I think that it had a value system that was quite pervasive. I mean, the way the families lived, of course, this was the 50s, the early 60s, and the way people managed their families, the kinds of choices that they made, the way that women took on different roles, and this was before the women's movement. So I really grew up in a world that wasn't just Stuyvesant Town, but was a world of the 50s and 60s. And Stuyvesant Town was a very homogenous community, and I think that shaped how I saw the world afterwards because I was sort of noticing those kinds of differences.
And when did you actually begin writing?
Oh, I began writing when I was a little kid and started my first novel in the little notebook and wrote little stories. I think all children are writers. I see it so much happening in the schools now where teachers are really encouraging kids to express themselves in their writing. So I've been writing forever. My spelling wasn't very good when I was little, but it's improving some.
Did you start out, like a lot of writers do, writing poetry, or did you actually start out with the genre of short stories, which is what you have continued to do?
I started with short stories. I think I was always interested in the story, and I wrote poems on the side, but my heart was really in the short story. And when I went to graduate school, it was the area that I ended up specializing in. I took on that impossible topic of what makes a good short story good, and then spent about 10 years reading short stories and trying to find the answer to that. I also found that the short story was a wonderful form when you're a young parent and you have a child who has a unpredictable sleep schedule, because you can actually begin something and end something during a nap or sometime. So I didn't really take on a novel until a few years later, but I was writing short stories from the time I was in junior high school on. I still love the genre.
Yeah, I can tell you, and you've written quite a few really good ones. But let's talk about your current novel, The Writing Circle. Was this inspired by real-life experience? Tell us a little bit about this six-member elite writing circle that you wrote about.
Well, I have to promise, I had to promise all of the members of my writing group that I would tell any audience I spoke to about the book that it's not about them. They're all thanked in the back of the book, and in fact, my own writing circle heard this novel chapter by chapter over a period of more than a year, and were my great supporters here. The characters in this novel are fictional. All writers say that, don't they?
But yeah, they do.
This is really true, and I've worked with them so long that now they seem like real people to me. But they're really fictional, and I selected characters who were writing in different genres because I really wanted to bring that whole broad spectrum into the novel. So we have a poet, and we have somebody who writes thrillers, and we have a historian, and we have somebody who writes biography, and we have two novelists. But they're entirely created characters, although, as I say, I don't think of them as real people.
Well, I was really fascinated by the famous poet. Her name is, what is it, Gillian or
Gillian? Yes.
Gillian was fascinating to me, this complex, famous woman poet. And she has
so
many flaws.
Which is almost an oxymoron, isn't it?
Yeah.
Famous and poet, yes.
She seemed a little bit more vicious than some of the famous poets that I've known.
Oh, she's deliciously vicious. And it's funny, I've been told, and I'd like to believe this is true, that I'm a kind person, and people have asked me, how could I have created a character like this? And I found her fascinating to work with. I just loved getting inside her and figuring out what made her tick. But I wouldn't like her very much as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd probably be a little bit scared of her, just as Nancy in the novel, who's the novelist in the novel, is a little bit intimidated by her. They all are, for good reason.
Well, was the character Nancy based a little bit on you?
Oh, she's much nicer than I am, and she thinks so much about everything. She really thinks about everything she does, and she tries to make really moral decisions. In some ways, it's really almost a tale of good and evil with Nancy sort of voicing all of the really ethical considerations about everything, and Gillian being almost amoral, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree with you on that one. But I did find her fascinating, I must say. Now, without giving away too much of the plot line, you do tackle the issue of plagiarism in this book. Now, tell us why you brought that into this book.
Oh, well, plagiarism is such a fascinating thing for writers to think about, and it's also an incredibly hot topic in the news today. I'm constantly amazed every time I read a news article about someone who has been discovered to be a plagiarist that people still do it, particularly in the age of the Internet, where it's very easy to find sources for things. And yet I guess there are a lot of arrogant people out there who just, you know, go ahead and take what they want, and some of them, as in a recent case, actually defend it and say it's okay, it's a kind of art. I teach at a college where, of course, we're very conscious about issues of plagiarism and very conscientious to make sure that our students are aware of it and work very hard to make sure that our students always credit things properly. But it's a really fascinating issue because it's stealing not just somebody's words, but really the creativity behind those words. It's sort of stealing a part of somebody. Of course, when I'm dealing with a group of writers and I'm thinking about the kinds of conflicts that occur among them, plagiarism is naturally going to come right to the front.
Mm-hmm. Now, it was sort of ambivalent in the book. Do you believe there's a fine line between re-rendering someone's work and actually stealing it?
Well, I, as a person, feel that people's work is really sacrosanct, that it's really their work. But what I wanted to do was to put the issue out on the table and to have my characters think about it and my readers think about it. And in this case, one of the characters who is, oh, and I can't say anything about the plot either, right? One of the characters who is accused of plagiarism actually is someone who has a fantastic memory. And so we really have to think about, is plagiarism true plagiarism if it's not deliberate, if someone does it without even being aware they're doing it? So there's a little bit of a gray area here. And of course, when you're a fiction writer, that's what you write about. You write about the gray areas.
But it was interesting because the character in the book did suggest that re-rendering a subject that had already come up from some other writer was not stealing it.
Yes, and I imagine that most readers would say not true. What about you? What did you think?
I thought it was pushing it to say that it wasn't plagiarism.
Yep.
That's what I came away with, yeah. Because so much of the essence of the original idea was stolen, it seems. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, in regard to the writers group, it seems that it was almost painful for me to watch some of these writers. I sense their vulnerabilities, and I even sense the envy. What did you feel about some of the characters? Did you want us to feel that?
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad you felt those things. I mean, every writer feels vulnerable when they bring their work and put it out on the table. I mean, we all, writers work in private. It's in the privacy of their head, in the privacy of their laptop, and then all of a sudden they've, there it is. It's out there, and they're waiting for people to give them feedback, and it can be terrifying. And writers are naturally going to be a little bit envious of each other. That was one reason why I actually chose different genres. So in this case, the writers aren't so competitive. They're not two poets in the group, but rather are actually competitive about their genre. And Jillian believes that poetry is superior. The novel is kind of like novels. The poor person who writes thrillers, Chris, who's very successful and makes a lot of money, nobody takes him as a serious writer, and he's constantly trying to prove himself. So there's a lot of conflict that goes on because of the kinds of things they write. And then when they actually meet and discuss their work, they're all trying to show off about what good critics they are and find little things in each other's work that they can point out. So there's a lot of envy and competitiveness that comes out in the critical process as well.
Well, you know, I wonder why writers would choose to put themselves through this critique from other writers. I would be afraid that there would be so much judgmental backstabbing.
Oh, there might be, but what you're hoping is that you will learn things from your critics that will help your work be better. And I think every writer's first care is to make their writing as good as it can possibly be. I find in my own writing group that what works best for me is when people in the group say things that confirm doubts that I might be having. And so what it is, it's really like my own best voice. And sometimes I hear things that I don't have the courage to say, and when I hear them, I say, yeah, I really have to attend to that. The writing group shouldn't be working to tell you things that are totally off the wall, but actually helping you work with your writing as you write it.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking to writer Corinne Demas. We're talking about her current novel, The Writing Circle. Now, tell us about the fact that you also teach. You say that this book is based on fiction, but were any of these fictional writers based on anybody you might know in academia?
Oh, there are certainly types in academia, aren't they? And I have one character who, he's just impossible, Bernard, and he's obtuse, and he's pedantic, and he is, I guess a little bit arrogant, I think there might be a few academics that are like that.
I have met a few like that.
But no one at Mount Holyoke. We're just wonderful faculty.
Now, let's talk a bit about the fact that you're also a fiction editor for the highly regarded literary journal, the Massachusetts Review. Tell us about what that job entails.
Well, the job entails reading hundreds of short stories and having to turn most of them down because we have so little space. I mean, sometimes it's really heartbreaking for me because I've been there and I still am on the other side of the table. I'm somebody who submits my work. What I do when I read manuscripts is I take off the cover letter and put it aside and just read the story. I don't want to know who the writer is. I don't want to know whether they're published or whether they're, you know, absolutely a new writer, just beginning. I want the story to really work for me as it is, and I just try to get into the story. I'm one of several editors. I'm not the only one. And the way we work is that we all just read a lot and then pass along the things that we think are wonderful. But the truth is, as with most literary magazines, we get so many more submissions than we can possibly publish. And so there's a lot of really fine fiction out there that we just don't have room for. And I guess I wanted to say a sort of heartening note to people who submit. I mean, we do read everything. I read it carefully, lovingly, but we don't have the time to really write back to people. We wish we had as many readers as we have people who are writing and submitting stories. But I love the short story, and I'm delighted that there are people out there who are producing them. And there's so many good stories, and many of them are written by people whose names you've never heard of.
Yeah, it's a wonderful journal. I have read it through the years. Now, it's been around for over 50 years, and it's known for its literary excellence. Well, when you decide that you like a writer, is it a committee that decides this? Do you have to pass it on, or do you have a final say?
Well, we pass it on. We don't actually sit together and mm-hmm. all talk about it. We sort of pass it on, and then it'll come back to us. And if you feel really strongly about it, you know, we write little notes about it, and we're not all sitting in a room at the same time, although we occasionally gather. It's interesting you should mention our 50th birthday, because one thing that we did for that was that we put together an anthology, and we read through back issues of the magazine and selected stories from our past, and we each took a certain number of years. We didn't take them like a solid decade, but we sprinkled them around, and we read and read, and then we all compiled this anthology. And I actually use it in my creative writing class, because some of the best stories in it are stories by authors whom we've never heard from again, but they're remarkable stories. And I want my students to see this, because I want them to realize that there's really powerful fiction out there that's being written by people whose names aren't household names. And I want them to trust their own reading judgments and really feel that they can like a story, even if it isn't, you know, in a collection that's heavily marketed and heavily publicized.
Well, going back to what we were talking about with the writing circle, when you talk about the issue of plagiarism, have you ever found a story submitted to the Massachusetts Review that you thought was plagiarized?
No, I haven't, and I guess I'm lucky about that. I've heard about plagiarism issues in various other places, but I've never encountered one.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, what are you looking for in young writers nowadays? Is it originality, or is it style, or is it something new that hasn't been tackled much? Tell us.
Oh, so that's a hard question, because there's so much. Stories work well in so many different ways, and what I want as a reader to feel is, I'm in a world, and I'm absolutely forgetting that this is something someone is writing. I'm absolutely in that story. I'm so immersed in it that I'm not thinking about the art. I'm not thinking about the artistry. I'm thinking just about what I'm being asked to think. I'm visualizing it. I'm hearing the characters speak. So I really want to read a story where the author is invisible and where the process is invisible. I also don't mind flawed stories. We get many stories that are simply well-made stories, but don't have that really remarkable original voice or something that happens. I don't mind a story that might be a little rough around the edges, but I want to see a story that's truly original and that's doing something for me in a way that hasn't been done before.
You know, we are sort of living through the Andy Warhol world, where everyone, no matter what, wants to be famous for 15 minutes, and half of them become so. Now, are you surprised that people still want to write and live in that solitary world and continue to be creative in these quiet rooms?
I love that question. I think it's not so much surprised as just really happy. What I tell my students is that publishing is fraught with stress and difficulty and unpredictability, but writing is a sure thing. I mean, you can really be happy writing. It's one of the few occupations where you really can control everything, where you can just be wherever you want to be and think whatever you want to think and produce it, and it's absolutely yours. And I try to get my students to remember that, so that they can actually enjoy the joy of writing and not get caught up in what happens later, which is trying to get your work published. In fact, most successful writers are different from the kind of people who are really good marketers. I think that if you're a marketing specialist, which might help your book, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a good writer. Today it's hard, because you almost have to be both.
And that's the way it is in the art world, too. I've talked to a lot of artists and how surprised they are that they also have to learn how to market themselves, which was quite new to them.
And many writers are shy people. They'd really much rather not have to face the public. What they want is for their words to be doing it for them. And, I'd love that, too. I'd love it if my books just sort of went off on their own and found their readers. And I, the author, Corinne Demas, didn't matter at all. Of course, it's fun to talk with people like you on the radio. I mean, that's actually a bonus. But the writing part is really the part that is the pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about how you tackle a novel. Do you come up with characters? Do you come up with plots? Do you come up with an atmosphere? How do you begin?
Well, in the writing circle, I started to get ideas about characters, and then I actually began with my ending. I knew where I wanted to go. This is unusual for me, and it was very exciting. It meant I had a plot. I knew where I wanted to end up. I've always been interested in unintended consequences, and I wanted to explore how different characters' lives will come together and something will happen, and all of the things that those characters do, things that they're not even aware of, things that they're not even thinking of, will contribute to something that will happen at the end. So that's what actually drove this novel and kept it going. And then what I did is I explored all of the different avenues. I spent time with each of my characters and tried to see how all of those threads came together.
In what way did you spend time with your characters? Just in your imagination, or were you visiting coffee houses or places where writers hang out? How did you visit?
Oh, in my imagination. I mean, they sort of inhabit my head, but I actually write much more about them than ends up in the book. So it's almost as if you're writing very long character sketches and learning about them. I mean, I like to know what my characters eat for breakfast and what kind of shoes they wear and what their sneeze sounds like when they sneeze and what they read and what kind of soap they like. All of those odd little things. And I don't know which I'll necessarily use, but I kind of want to know everything about them. I want to know, where they came from and what their families were like and what they're thinking. And then when they talk, I hope it will ring true because they're them.
Well, I actually found the book very fascinating. I was really taken in by these characters. And the one thing that I was hoping, Corinne, that maybe you were going to do a spin-off afterwards of some of these characters, because I was really curious to know what was going to happen next.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. I've thought about it. I sort of been asked about whether I'd want to do an epilogue, and there are so many characters that I'd like to follow up on. When you're a writer, you develop a certain affection for your characters, and I felt sad, I felt bereft when I sent this novel off. It was as if I was parting with all of these good friends, and I'd love to revisit some of them. And their stories really do continue. I mean, I've told part of their tale, and I've told the part where they overlap, but each of them has his or her own life, and they're going off on those lives, and they're interesting to me still. So, thank you for suggesting that.
Well, I hope you'll follow up on it. I really do. Now we talked a little bit about the fact that you teach at Mount Holyoke College. You teach creative writing. Is that correct?
Yes, I do, and I teach some literature courses also. I have a background, and I have a PhD in literature, so I kind of wear two hats. I teach about the literature, but I also teach creative writing, and I tend to bring a lot of the literature into my writing courses and also bring a lot of the creative writing into my literature courses.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've talked to a lot of teachers who are obviously teaching in the lower grades, and so many of them talk about how worried they are about literacy, and so many kids don't seem to be prepared. Are you finding that at all at your level?
Well, Mount Holyoke's a selective college, so our students tend to come to us very well prepared. But I do know, and I certainly hear this from high school teachers, that there's a longing for perhaps a more old-fashioned kind of preparation and students who really learned how to write and to read better before they got there.
So kids, they're not really kids, they're young adults that come to you at the college. What kinds of help do they need with their writing? What can you really teach creativity?
You can't teach creativity at all. And I tell them this in the beginning of my seminars, and I say, here's what I can do for you and here's what I can't. And what I can do for them is assign them things and make them right. And I can give them feedback on what they do right. I can give them constructive feedback and create a seminar where we have a peer group that's working so that they can listen to each other. They actually learn more about their own writing by thinking about their classmates' writing. I mean, everyone in a creative writing course wants to talk about their own work, but in fact, sometimes it's hard for them to hear things about their own work, but they can hear it when they are talking about somebody else's story. So, for instance, let's talk about a very common problem among student writers, and older writers too, which is verbosity. Everyone loves her own words, and it's hard to cut. But when you're reading something else, you can see where a paragraph might be bogged down, and you can learn techniques that will help you make it cleaner and crisper. And then you can take those and bring them back and use them for your own work. What I try to do with my students is get them to separate their creative process from their editing process so that they write their stuff and put it out and then put on their editor's hat on a different day and look at the text as objectively as they can, as if it's not theirs. Mm-hmm. And always have it in print so that they're not looking at their handwriting, because everyone has a certain affection for his or her own handwriting. If you're looking at it in a nice Times New Roman or Bodoni, whatever, then it somehow seems more like text, and it's easier to make changes.
We do only have a few more minutes left. I do want to talk to you a little bit about the fact that you also write and have written very many children's books. How do you put yourself into the mindset to do that?
Oh, I love writing children's books. I think it came about because I had kids, and they're such so much fun to write. And kids are a wonderful audience, and they give you great feedback. They're absolutely candid, and so it's been great for me to have books come out and to talk to kid readers and get ideas for new stories. And it's also a very nice change from writing for adults. There are things that I can do in children's books that I can't do in an adult novel, and there are obviously certain things that I can write about in adult novels that I can't do in a children's book. So I think these two, you know, in a way, separate careers work together really well. And it's very nice when you're in the midst of a long novel, which can go on, the work process can go on for years, to take a break and to write a children's book. And my children's books, some of them are longer and more lyrical. Some of them are shorter. I have a new one that's coming out that's in rhyming couplets. And it's really fun to write in a different voice.
Well, that's great. Well, Corinne Demas, thank you so much for joining us. Can you give us some contact information so people can get in touch with you?
Well, the best way to get in touch with me is through my website, which is CorinneDemas.com.
Corinne Demas, thank you so much for joining us. And I do recommend go out and buy The Writing Circle. It's a wonderful summer novel to read. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.